Hi, this is John Udall. My guest for this week's podcast is Dan Chudnov. He's a programmer who's worked on library information systems at MIT, at Yale, and soon at the Library of Congress, where he'll be starting a new job shortly. This conversation is a kind of a sequel to an earlier one with Tony Hammond of Nature Publishing Group. Tony talked about how digital object identifiers are being used in the world of academic publishing to create a stable long-term framework for persistent linking and reliable citation. There's a related technology called OpenURL. It plays a role in academic publishing, and it's also something that folks like Dan Chudnov are approaching from the perspective of libraries that need citations to be not only durable and persistent, but also to be able to redirect into the holdings of a particular library. It all sounds kind of esoteric, and in a lot of ways it is. But these questions of digital archiving and persistent linking will matter more and more because we're all creating the library of the future.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. I gather you have moved to my alma mater.
No, actually, I come from there. I've had that address for like 16 years.
Oh, okay.
I got both of my degrees in Michigan.
Oh, but are you not at Yale now?
I'm between jobs, literally. I've been working at Yale for a while, and I'm actually about to start a new job in a few weeks.
Okay.
I'm going to be working at the Library of Congress starting the first week of March.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, thanks.
What will you be working on?
There's a newish unit there called the Office of Strategic Initiatives, and in that unit there are a number of software development groups, and I'll be on one of them. This group is tasked with building, buying, selecting, implementing new systems for other parts of the library.
Wow.
That's a pretty broad scope, but I think most of what they do right now is building digital repository systems.
Sounds like the perfect thing for you.
Well, I hope so. We'll see.
So you'll be moving to Washington?
Yeah, it's a big move because we've been in New Haven for I've been here 10 years. My wife has been here for about 12 years.
Hmm.
But it's an exciting job. The door's kind of wide open, it seems.
Well, good for you. I was thinking about how we should frame this.
Okay.
And it's a challenge because...
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Well, first of all, you operate in this domain of folks who call themselves library geeks. And I tend to operate in this domain of folks who call themselves sort of general purpose geeks.
Yeah.
And there's translation, there's much translation that needs to go on even just between those two realms.
It's true.
But the larger and more difficult translation that needs to go on is to sort of everybody else as mm-hmm. to what the heck is any of this stuff about and why should we care?
Yeah.
That's quite a challenge for us, but still I think we should try.
Okay.
What I had hoped to do here was kind of a follow-on to the conversation with Tony Hammond, where we dived into the entrails of the digital object identifier system. And
right.
I was trying to relate that to a general problem that everybody has, and I think that that's completely valid, which is that we're all increasingly in the situation of needing to care about this question of the persistence of our digital artifacts, which we have more and more of all the time. Why don't we kind of start there from the perspective of the various library-related linking and resource identification standards that you've been involved in. So if you could sort of back up and state the problem first in a way that everyone can relate to, that would probably be a good place to start.
Okay. Well, Tony certainly is eminently qualified to speak on these things, and I really enjoyed your conversation. He's had his hands and been a member of committees and things, and I've done a lot less of that. I've been more of an informal participant in standards. So what you'll get from me is a little bit more of the casual library employee view of a lot of these things, but hopefully that'll be practical in another way.
Yeah.
Well, should we start with names, or should we start with the storage and preservation question?
Well, maybe we should start with the perspective that someone has who is on the web and runs into this funny-looking thing called an open URL.
Well, sure.
And talk about sort of what that is, what it's doing for me, and why.
The further I get into this, the more I like to frame things as really old questions.
Uh-huh.
Just reappearing. The problem you're trying to solve when you run into an open URL is really an old problem. It's as old as research itself. And that problem is to follow the history of thought in a problem space. When you read somebody's article and they relate it to work that's come before, you want to be able to follow the references, essentially, and see which giant's shoulders they've been standing on and verify that these people are building on the right combination of work when they're proposing a new idea or a new solution to a problem. And part of that is simply verifying that their statement of the problem is accurate and they know what they're talking about. And the more important, probably progressive aspect of that is being able to verify scientific results and claims. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to follow people's references if you want to do science.
Sure. And obviously everything changed when we got the ability to turn footnotes into things that actually went someplace in real time. That was amazing. It still is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this problem is not just as old as footnotes in academic journals, which are several hundred years old, but it's also more to the point, it's as old as computing. Garfield and his work with ISI analyzing citation results dates back more than 50 years. So as long as there have been computers to help with this kind of thing, there have been people who are ready to do this kind of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what you want to be able to do if you're reading an article online, much like you would want to do if you have a physical copy of a paper, is when you're looking at the references, you want to go and follow those references. You want to find which journals, which issues, which volumes, which pages these references people are citing are relevant to your understanding of the problem you're trying to understand from the author's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally need to go into the book stacks, the journal stacks, whatever, and find that volume, that issue, that page of that journal so you can find the article. And this is exactly the problem as it translates to the web that led to the development of the Open URL standard 7-8 years ago.
Okay.
That problem is you're using an online article, you're reading an article in an online journal, and at the bottom of the article there are a bunch of references. And the references aren't homogeneous in any way in the sense that, well, they're kind of formatted the same probably visually, and there's obviously styles people use to keep this consistent, short form of the author name and a title of an article and a short form of the journal title and reference to volume, issue, year, page. But that's really hard to translate mechanically online for a couple of reasons. One is that metadata, first of all, is very sloppy. Author names are ambiguous. Journal names can be ambiguous. Journal names change over time. Journal splits. Book titles are mistyped, misquoted, that sort of thing. There's a lot of slop in the system.
So hang on just a second. Let me back up and ask a kind of a naive devil's advocate question. Assuming that the article that you want to read online has been published by someone somewhere online, mm-hmm. it will have been published at a URL, and you don't care, shouldn't need to care what is contained in that URL. It's just an opaque thing that you click and bingo, you go to the article, right? But obviously there's more to the problem.
Right.
Especially in the case of libraries, especially in the case of holdings, which are accessible to library patrons or someone at a particular university. So there's this question of getting redirected to, you know, sort of your local copy of the thing that you're allowed to read.
Exactly. That's really where they were starting to solve the problem here with the open URL. What people working in this area recognized immediately was that any particular library, particularly like a big research library, is likely to have subscriptions to most of the kinds of journals that most people in a certain field would be looking for. But the journal subscriptions themselves, although they're all online and the articles are all published online, and of course that's actually very new. If we go back 6 or 7 years, that wasn't necessarily so at all.
Mm-hmm.
This is all actually very recent,
mm-hmm.
that you could assume that most recent things would be online.
Yeah.
But they're all published by different publishers. And the different publishers maybe publish the journals themselves on their own sites, or they contract with third parties to publish them for them in their own systems. Or there are gateway systems that essentially aggregate resources from a variety of publishers into whole new interfaces. And when you're working at a big library like Yale University's libraries, not only are you going to have an unholy combination of all these subscription agents and aggregators and source publishers themselves subscribe to in your library, but the resources themselves are going to overlap. So when you follow a reference link, what you need to know is whether you have that journal at your library, and not just whether you have that journal, but which systems you can use to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And within that, which of those systems actually allow you the specificity of naming a volume, an issue, a page, an author name, a unique identifier, and can get you right to that article itself.
Okay.
What you really want to be able to do is bring people right to the full text of article with one click.
Okay.
Unfortunately, for all these reasons, it's just not always that easy.
It seems that there are a couple different things going on here. So In one case, the need for an intermediary would be obviated if we were in an open access regime and there were a canonical archive.org URL. For, let's say, a math article or a physics article, then it's not going to be a question of needing to get redirected to my library's copy of that thing, because we can just use the canonical copy. right?
In theory, that's the sort of thing that works in the short term. In reality, in our experience, resources move. If you watched even the history of individual publishers who've been online since the early days of the web, and you follow the URL patterns that lead to articles at their own sites, and remember every system upgrade they've gone through and every time they've overhauled, you know, the web backend and replaced it with a new one, even if there were some single site that tried to preserve some sort of links, from the perspective of a librarian, you kind of have to assume that even they will change their linking structure over time.
Even archive.org?
Sure. Although archive.org isn't really organized to provide this kind of access. Secondarily, archive.org is not an arbiter of which resources a particular library has subscribed to. So whether or not you can get to the links is independent of whether you as an individual working through your institution or maybe independently have rights to see what's behind the link. There are all these things that can come up and cause problems. The identifier aspect of this is one big step in mitigating some of these issues, because if you have a known unique identifier, you can recognize that as such and have a little more mechanical strength in trying to resolve it to a direct link. A lot of what you talked with Tony Hammond is in that space.
So the DOI being an example of such an identifier?
Yes. Other obvious kinds of identifiers are URIs in general, and you know, PubMed identifiers, if you're in the medical space like I've been working in most recently. These are well known, they're well understood, they're easily recognized, and they're usually fairly easily resolved. Now, one of the jobs I've had in a previous life was I was working on the DSpace project at MIT Libraries about 6 years ago. And even just the how to generate IDs and resolve identifiers problem alone on that project was a source of endless debate, and it's not even... what we came up with isn't even necessarily something that pleases all parties all the time.
Well, and apparently it's changed over time as well, right?
Yeah, it has, I think. And different institutions have chosen to implement it differently.
So, for example, Tony was saying that initially the recommendation was to make them completely opaque and not intending to be meaningful to humans, but that eventually people realized that was a bad idea and it, there should be some human readability of the identifier.
Well, what you really want to be able to do is recognize, you know, identifier patterns at least.
Yeah.
You know, if you see something with a PMID in it, and it's structured in an info URI, which is another effort Tony was involved in developing, then you can predictably, you know, figure out what that is.
Right.
With the DSpace project, one of our explicit goals was to solve this, in many ways, to support open access publishing by making it easier for authors and institutions to publish their own works by... as much as anything else, not only taking a copy of the content and offering to manage that over time, but also simply offering a stable URL. If you talk to a number of authors at MIT 5 years ago, they would line up right away and tell you that, sure, they'd been publishing their own articles, but the graduate assistant system administrator had moved on and the system had been compromised and now the links don't work and they've been publishing papers and no one can get to their articles anymore. Yes, please take a copy of this for me and give it a stable URL that I can cite.
So in response to the thing that Tony and I did, a number of people pointed out that there are any number of ways to materialize a persistent URL. And ultimately, you know, there are sort of technical questions about how you manage that process, but really it comes down to governance and infrastructure and a business model that enables that to be sustained over time.
That's true. You can think about that in a very kind of centralized, monolithic way. Like, what if there were one organization whose job it would be to do this? Or you can think about it in a very distributed way. And being a librarian, this is the way, you know, we tend to think about it. We all have different libraries because there is this nexus of need in a given institution to centralize some of those responsibilities for a specific community. So in this particular sense, I think there's an importance to the role of needing some sort of distributed identification and resolution step, because if all their libraries put their eggs in one basket with one centralized service, and then anything happened to that one centralized service, you know, it's the traditional single point of failure problem. We simply can't provide the service we need to our communities.
Right.
So negotiating this spectrum of where what you need to centralize, what you need to distribute is an ongoing and fairly difficult process.
Right. But there's also the question of whether you consider any given implementation of this idea. So let's take the DOI handle stuff, for example. In one sense, it's a decentralized system in that there are going to be multiple handle servers and resolvers and so on.
Right, and you distribute the naming authorities as well.
And distributed naming authority. But in another sense, it's kind of a single thing in the sense that it's somebody's business to run that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And in practical terms, the way it's been implemented is that it is almost entirely done through a single resolution step. Through the organization whose responsibility that is. Most people who implement handles, now, of course, DOI is an application of the handle system as well that has its own back end, but handles in general, if you were to get a copy of the handle system from CNRI and run it and start assigning handles in Microsoft for your documents, you would either need to make a choice to use the centralized handle system to resolve those HTTP projections of handle identifiers into the public internet.
Yes.
Or you need to implement your own system to do that.
Yes.
And that's exactly the same centralized distributed question all over again.
Right. Right. So it's confusing.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
Yeah. It's not just me. Okay.
Yeah, when it works great, it's a huge improvement, but it doesn't necessarily clean everything up all tidily. Mm-hmm. And of course, organizations are bought and sold, and not that we expect Microsoft to be bought or sold anytime soon, but organizations change over time certainly as well, and missions change, and they merge and they split and they die. When you're trying to think about the long term, you know, these questions inevitably come up.
This feels to me like a replay of another debate I've been having with myself and other people. So, for example, in another context, the question about social networks and the multiplicity of social networks.
Good question.
You know,
yeah.
Versus the overarching, if you want to call it a social network, which the internet is or potentially is. You know, I can look at these various schemes for URL persistence and the decentralized networks that support that idea as a bunch of contenders for something which is ultimately wanting to be rolled up and simply be part of the fabric of the internet.
In a way that it isn't already?
In a way that it isn't already, yeah. So, for example, what we don't have as part of the fabric of the internet is both a technical infrastructure and a governance infrastructure in support of archiving and preservation and persistent reference. It's just not a property of the internet itself. So we're creating it in a variety of add-on layers, which to an outsider look like a confusing landscape because they're both, in some ways, I guess, competitive, but also overlapping.
Well, in one way, you could look at the brilliance of the HTTP specification and the model for URIs and URNs and URLs and say, well, they've enabled us to build that.
Mm-hmm.
But haven't really specified all the details about how and why to do that.
Right.
Another way to think of it, and I guess this is something else I wanted to say about open URLs, is in this case, I think what's really happening that's always going to complicate things is you're not just crossing between, you know, user interfaces and machine interfaces, but you're inevitably crossing into meat space.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dealing with individuals that are not in front of their machines and physical media that are not connected.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the problem we can't ignore in libraries. And on that level, we have hierarchies of authority and responsibility, from individual responsibility to organizational affiliation to networks of organizations. And in a sense, if this tapestry that's building out on the net, this thing that's missing, is approximating the complexity of meat space, then in some sense, then maybe it is fully built. In another sense, maybe the tapestry doesn't work unless there are clear overlaps and interconnections between the two.
Well, I actually thought where you were going with that was to point out that the DOI, for example, is a really concise token that can be printed at the end of an article and, you know, is a small number of characters that someone actually could write down on a 3x5 card and take away with them. And I thought
that's
that,
true.
Yeah, I thought that was actually a pretty important property.
I wouldn't dispute that at all.
Yeah.
But would you put a DOI on your business card?
I don't know. What would it point to?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's an interesting contrast there, in fact, which I wanted to ask you about to sort of get back to the open URL. And open URL, as I understand it, looks more like a query. You know, so I'm looking at one example of an open URL here, and it has HTTP colon some resolver domain name.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a bunch of name value pairs, right? So article title, volume, issue, date, page, journal title, ISSN, and so on, right? So in fact, what it looks like is happening here is this is, it seems very similar to what Tony was describing as the query process going into the DOI and handle stuff, where you want to get back a concise identifier, but you need to ask the system, what would that be for these values? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it is. The way the standard is written is, unfortunately, it's a little too complex. I'm both a huge fan and a huge critic of the OpenURL standard itself.
Mm-hmm.
What they're describing is a framework for context-sensitive linking.
Mm-hmm.
And what they mean there is that for any given bibliographic object you're referencing, you want to do exactly what you just described. You want to run a query for the services that are available to me through my institution for this object. And hopefully what most people are doing most of the time is they're trying to find a full text link.
Right.
So in that scenario, whether or not you find an identifier per se isn't of primary importance.
Okay.
If an identifier comes with the query, it's helpful in locating the resolution step.
Okay.
Which resource is going to have a copy of that and getting you precisely to the copy of that instance you want. The trick, though, is you might not just want to find full text. What you might really want to do is save a reference to this.
Right.
Or you might want to do a cited reference lookup. Or you might end up wanting to do an interlibrary loan request.
Right.
If you find through the system that you don't have a local copy. The way most OpenURL resolver systems work in the 1,000 or so libraries that are using them is this query results in a human interface offering options.
Okay.
If at all possible, there's a physical link, whether it's through an identifier and a system like DOI or not, that will take you right to that article. Usually it's going to be an article. That should be first. Typically, at a place like Yale, for the highest impact factor journals, you're going to get several options for the same journal.
Okay.
You're going to be able to go directly to a publisher site. You're going to be able to go to an open access copy of it. You're going to be able to go to an aggregated version of it in something like LexisNexis, Academic Universe, that kind of resource, or a gateway subscription service like EBSCO.
Okay.
So you might get several copies of links that are all different, that are all going to take you to versions of the article. And below that, you'll get links to an interlibrary loan service if you weren't lucky above that.
Okay.
Now, another project I've been working on, and some other people in the community are trying to improve this step, is basically what you're doing is not only are you presenting users who typically just want to get right to the full text with this confusing screen offering these options in the middle of which is a full text link, so just take me there, darn it. But you're moving users through three different systems at once. For every reference you want to follow, you need to come up out of the silo of content you started in,
mm-hmm.
which might or might not be the same one you have to go back to a month later to get to the same article.
Mm.
Step through the library's user interface,
mm-hmm.
remember how to follow the links in there, and end up at the ultimate site, which might be, again, different from 1 month to the next, depending on library subscriptions,
mm-hmm.
which come and go and change over time as well.
Okay.
And that's really confusing. Every time one of my colleagues has reported to me informally or more publicly on usability testing results from OpenURL screens, the result is almost invariably, I think I know from this that if I click the first thing, I'll get to the full text, and I remember seeing it, so I do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't read it. They don't remember the different options, because these screens are they're typically just not that good yet. They need a lot of improvements. So a project I'm working on now, I've been consulting on this effort called Library Find, a meta-search project coming from the Oregon State University Libraries, funded by the state of Oregon. It's a meta-search tool which allows you to search multiple resources at once.
Mm-hmm.
And we've basically embedded an OpenURL resolver into the result stream so that when you do a search on someone's name like yours or a topic or the name of a book, hopefully what you're going to get are not just links to OpenURL resolver screens, because we control the whole system, right? We've got this front-end to back-end searches that are licensed resources, and we've got the OpenURL resolver, and we have the knowledge base of which resources we're subscribed to.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do is reduce it to two clicks. You send your search query to find what you want, and if we can find a link directly to full text, we're just going to give you that link right away in the results. So one click to find, one click to get.
Okay.
And when we've done usability testing on this, It's amazing. There's no question what it does. People instinctively want to just click on the results and get the full text of the article.
Right.
When you're doing article searching. And when we're able to provide that, which is in many cases, people don't even recognize what's happening because the number of systems they've moved through has been reduced and the number of screens we're confusing them with has gone down.
Okay.
Of course, this doesn't always work. If you're doing book searching, you're trying to find a book, you're not necessarily going to find an ebook copy. So then we have to move you through data from the online catalog and figure out if it's online and figure out where it is on the shelves and whether it's checked out. And these problems just don't go away. There's always this possibility for great confusion. But we're trying to find ways, both through this project at Oregon State and a lot of other initiatives going on in the community to shorten these steps.
From the person's perspective who's using a system that's instrumented this way, there's the question of what is the query that I formulate? And the open URL, although they probably don't interact with it directly, is a way of formulating that query, right? So I know the title and the author. I'll put in that much and
right.
Hopefully get back a result set that I can scan. And then, as you described through this interactive step, I can refine that. But on the other end of it, I want to cite this thing. And I want to cite it in a way that is canonical and durable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at that point, what does that part of the process look like? You know, where do I end up with the open URL that I want to point other people to?
So that's a tricky question, again, for a few reasons. One is that when somebody puts through an open URL query, you might or might not have a robust, accurate set of metadata in that query.
Right.
If you have an identifier or you have some complex matching heuristics, you can restore metadata into that transaction, much like, there's this great book by Daniel Hillis, The Pattern on the Stone, where he talks about the ways you can build complex CPUs with Tinker Toys or something like that. But over time, the noise gets into the system because of the realities of physics. And you have to essentially provide redundancy so you can restore the logic at any point where the logic might have been corrupted or lost some signal.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what needs to happen at that moment is we need to restore metadata. We need a restoring metadata system. And in some cases, certainly when you have things like a reference object that you're passing by reference with an identifier, you can do that fairly reliably. If you have some combination of fields like title and author and pages and publication date, it's a bit more of a crapshoot.
Mm-hmm.
But if at all possible, you do want to be able to restore that full record. And in addition to providing a service which would lead people to full text, you do want to provide a canonical citation form.
And what would that look like?
Well, I think one system that's implemented this is the O-Link system, which a group in Ohio Link, has done for libraries across the state of Ohio. And I think what they provide is literally the text string that you would want to use if you want to cite this reference in your paper.
And how would that look?
Well, it's back to what we see in printed journals. It's the short form of the author name, a title, volume, issue, page, journal name, and date.
Oh, okay.
And that's great. But immediately then you start thinking about, and this gets back to social bookmarking and all of that.
Yes.
You want to do the kind of thing that Tony and his colleagues at Nature have done with Konotea. You want to be able to share this thing.
Yes.
That was how I discovered social bookmarking. We were already using open URL systems. And in about 2003, at this fun conference I go to every year in Canada called Access, we do this thing called the Hackfest where we take suggestions for wacky ideas and work on them for a day just to get our minds around new technologies and work with each other and have fun. We thought about what it would look like if you could just track a community's open URL resolutions and just have a stream that would show up and a feed you could subscribe to of all the references people are going to over time. And in a lot of ways, this is what social bookmarking is. You're reading over people's shoulders. You're seeing what your friends are reading.
Right.
What I think hasn't happened yet is for those two areas of functionality to really be bridged. Like, I don't think there's an open URL resolver on the market that not only provides full text links and a citation form, but also automatically lets you save a robust citation into a community bookmarking service. But thinking about those issues led us to this other generic problem, which is, well, what if I'm working at Yale, which is all well and good for me. I'm lucky to be there. They have great resources. But if I'm writing a paper, I want to publish it on the net. If I want to blog about it.
Exactly.
How do I put up open URL links that other people can follow?
Yes.
This is a huge problem. And We've come up with a temporary solution to that. Again, it's another community initiative, and this one's called Coins.
Okay, I've seen it.
Coins is awkward for all of the reasons that OpenURL is awkward, but it is also very simple in that it's a way to specify an OpenURL in a span tag in HTML.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to disconnect the user and the publisher so that there's no presumption of knowing where the user's coming from. And for the user visiting a blog entry with a reference in it, there's no presumption that the person publishing the link is, you know, assuming that you should go to some specific publisher site because you might want to go somewhere else.
So in other words, it takes the resolver out of the equation and just packages up the raw metadata that would be the query that would retrieve the article?
Exactly that. And it does that using the exact terms of the most common formats for referencing articles and books from OpenURL.
So then you would need a companion piece of software that would attach to your local resolver.
Right, which is both great and a problem.
Right.
Great because it opens up this opportunity for bookmarklets and grease monkey scripts.
Yeah.
And we've all been through that.
Yeah.
And it works great. What we've done is we came up with a simple way to activate a coin. So coin stands for context object in span.
Mm-hmm.
Context object being the part of OpenURL that specifies this metadata package that you're sending over the wire.
Right.
And span being the span tag in HTML. It's essentially like a microformat. We were working on this before we knew about microformat.
Right.
Maybe we would have tried to consolidate all the terms. I don't know. But basically, it's a microformat-like convention for putting your context object into a span tag.
How would you form that thing?
Well, you can form it by hand, of course.
Yeah.
That's kind of a pain. There are a couple sites on the net that will allow you to generate one. I think the division of OCLC called Openly Informatics has a coins generator script that you can use. I don't know if there's a web service to that or not, but it would make sense that there would be.
Okay.
So you can basically send it terms and it will give it back to you. There are also blog plugins. I think there's one for WordPress.
Oh, yeah?
We've also worked on one using the structured blogging tools. If you're familiar with that, if you download that stuff, one of the bundled reference types is a journal and another one is a book. If you just type in a few fields for title, author, journal name, publisher name, and a date, volume, issue, pages, all that same stuff, or an identifier, it will generate a coins for you.
Okay.
Of course, those aren't necessarily widely used. There's a huge step with being able to publish it there. But hopefully that simplified some of it, and we found a few of these on the net. The problem then goes back to how do you give people this thing they have to install?
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
What we're learning is that if you make people install something, they won't do it.
Yeah.
Unless it comes with, you know, the Microsoft Office suite or Firefox. You know, if it's not something that's right there and one click away, it's not something people are going to find on their own.
Exactly.
So fortunately, there's been some more work done on this. OCLC has what they're calling the OpenURL Resolver Registry. They've collected records from over 1,000 institutions of where their OpenURL resolvers are, what mechanisms they support, what the links to them are, what the icon and you want to display for them are, what the short, you know, catchy local title of it is, whether it's Get Links or Yale Links in the case of Yale, or Get It or Find It or whatever it might be. It varies across institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've done, I've worked with them to produce a simple database of grease monkey scripts and bookmarklets for all the institutions in that registry so that librarians can go and get one of these things and distribute it on their campus.
Okay, I think I've seen that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that works. You know, there's just no denying that it works. It's people are publishing coins, and there are some sites that are fairly visible that are publishing coins now, including WorldCat.org and Wikipedia, and just some work has just been done in Wikipedia to actually improve the quality of coins coming out. So anytime the standard Wikipedia citation for journal, citation templates for journal articles or books are used, a coins is going to come out.
So let's walk through this because a grease monkey script or the equivalent in IE is kind of a non-starter for most people. A bookmarklet is problematic, but at least more broadly accessible. So assuming the bookmarklet, right, what would be the flow here? How would this work?
As is the problem with any bookmarklet, you have to go and get it and install it. You need to find the one for your institution.
Right, but assuming you've gotten that.
Yeah, if you've gone and done that, you've got it sitting in your toolbar, whether you're in IE or Firefox or Opera or Safari. If you're on a page that has references, you'd be presumably intelligent enough or experienced enough to know that if you click that, you might find links back from references to your own.
Would the page let you know that it had the stuff that would be activated by that bookmarklet? Or
we don't have a convention for that.
Okay.
No. If you're using the Grease Monkey form, it'll just pop up automatically,
right.
And you'll see the link.
Right.
If you're using a database that you're familiar with, you'll probably learn that you can try clicking your bookmarklet.
Okay.
This is an area of usability where people don't necessarily get it right away, but we typically have repeat users.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether someone's an undergraduate or a faculty member, they're around for a few years. After a while, you get to know the databases you're using, and you recognize the patterns.
So I'm on a page, and it has references, and the references are encoded as coins, which are these micro-formatted thingies inside of span tags.
Mm-hmm.
And I click the bookmarklet in order to do what? What happens now?
Little icons that point back to your institutional open URL resolver will show up in the page.
Okay.
Those kind of headless, server nameless coins tags, which are basically context objects not bound to a specific resolver on the net,
okay,
are turned into additional, you know, anchor links with an href that is a fully formatted open URL link.
Okay.
That takes the context object it found in the coins and binds that to your institutional resolver. Hopefully pops up the icon for your institutional links and a little short name of it.
So this is on the reading side.
Yes.
If I'm writing something, and in particular if I'm writing something for the web, is there even a procedure available that would enable me to form some sort of open URL enabled link that I could publish out to people who would then resolve it wherever they happen to be?
If you're writing your own system and you're going to be doing a lot of this, it's fairly easy to tweak your user interface template to push your metadata into a coin span tag. That's straightforward. If you have the metadata in hand, if your system's robust enough to have these fields delineated, you can just follow the convention and publish them that way. If you're a blogger, you're going to want to rely on one of these things like the WordPress plugin or the structured blogging plugins for movable type or Drupal.
And you configure those to work against your local catalog?
You can both publish your own open URL links in your own posts that by default go to your own institution, particularly if you're writing a weblog for your own institution.
Okay.
But there's no reason you can't co-publish that with an open coins, so that people who come to your weblog, they might see a Yale link, but if they recognize that, they might click their bookmarklet and find, say you have one running at Microsoft. If you have a Microsoft resolver, you can have a bookmarklet for your Microsoft resolver and follow that into the Microsoft Research Lab.
I think I'm starting to get the picture here.
Yeah, it's not a clear picture.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, it's so confusing.
I understand. So, but in principle, I could be a blogger who is intending to bridge between the realm of academic discourse and the realm of public discourse in the blogosphere, and could do so by using some sort of a plugin that would present me with a form into which I would place partial information about a resource, an article, and would get back a sort of a completed version, and would get it back in a form, potentially multiple forms, but one of which would be this coins thing that could be embedded into my blog posting, which then could be interpreted by a coins interpreter or resolver or client, whatever you call it, by someone somewhere else. Okay.
That would be a useful service, and I think I mentioned, I think that OCLC Openly Informatics has a coins generator that you can find off the main coins page at ocoins.info.
Okay. My follow-on question here is because I've, for some reason, been deeply vexed by this question.
It's vexing.
It doesn't seem to bother most people, but I worry a whole lot about the way in which, in the blogosphere, we are able to know who is paying attention to which resource by looking at sites like Delicious and Technorati to see, you know, who's been linking to or pointing to this thing. But the thing, the referent, is very sensitive, even case sensitive.
Oh, yeah. I read your post about that recently.
From the standpoint of aggregating the attention that flows to a resource, we have systems that, on the one hand, work remarkably well, really. I mean, when you think about it, it's kind of amazing how aware you can be of the attention that flows to a resource in the blogosphere.
It's amazing, yeah.
But on the other hand, it's incredibly fragmentary if there are multiple manifestations of that URL, right? So this question of what is the canonical thing that is the attention attractor is something I think a lot about, and I'm wondering how that would map into this space. So we're kind of back to that question of, you can have an open, as I understand it, you can have an open URL, I'll call it a query, which can look lots of different ways, right? I mean, the ordering of the parameters could vary. The values of the parameters could vary because the resolver, like you said, could fix things up, right? So if you get the title quite right, it might fix that for you.
Right.
You might have varying amounts of detail encoded in the query. So, you know, some resolvers could go all the way down to the page, others would only get you to the article. And so it seems like you're set up to generate lots of different variants of that query. And if, on the other hand, that query is an URL that you want to function as an attention attractor, then you have to canonicalize that somehow. What is the canonicalized version of it?
Well, this is the sloppy underbelly of libraries again. To me, I look at this and say, well, there isn't an easy answer, and that's all there is to it. You know, I mean, it's sloppy. I mean, you go again back to what, no matter how much work you can do to provide physical mechanisms on the internet to tie these things together and weave them into a singular fabric, somebody's going to jot it down on paper.
Yeah.
And when you jot it down on paper and then type that back in, you know, noise gets into the system.
In principle, what do you think the canonicalized version of that could be or should be?
I think this just gets into deep questions of philosophy that I'm not trained to answer. You've been writing recently about surface area.
Yeah.
And your surface area of publishing, I couldn't help but think of that when you started talking about expressions, which is a magic trigger to librarians like me, because we have this model called FERBR, the Functional Requirements for Bibliographic Records, that talk about the relationship between works of authorships and variations on those, such as expressions of a musical work or versions, editions of a printed book, and so forth. And expressions is a key word in that phrase.
Right.
So when you think about an object of some platonic form, the surface area of expressions of that object is pretty diverse.
True.
And the more popular something is, the more thorny shapes and little dropouts you're going to have over that topology.
Right.
One of which is metadata representations of it that essentially surrogate the in-hand copy, which you don't have when you're looking at a query engine.
Yeah.
So, sort of by definition, there is loss between representing an object through metadata and the object itself.
Right.
Particularly when it's hard to say what the object itself really is when we have PDF copies and HTML copies and AAC files and MP3 files and so on, and transcripts of the following.
Well, apart from the fact that there is, at least according to many people, no apparent business model to support this yet, I can at least imagine a scenario in which blog publishing software thinks in a similar way to, let's say, book publishing, right? I mean, through my experiments with Library Lookup, I learned more than I ever imagined I would learn about ISBNs and that whole system. And as a matter of fact, it does work out pretty well at this point, you know. So for the versions of Library Lookup that go through the OCLC, the service that takes an ISBN, which is one of those belonging to the cluster.
Right, XISBN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, XISBN.
Yeah.
That's a pretty workable scheme, I think. And in principle, I mean, we already have in the blog world, we have this notion of GUIDs. We don't use them really very much. But we could sort of, it could work without a whole lot of fuss, except I think it's just not, it's not a problem that's it's not a problem that's interesting to many people, right? Because people, I think we think about what happens in the blogosphere as this kind of throwaway stuff, or at least most people do. I mean, I don't at all, but I think for most people it's sort of like, well, this, you know, who cares, right? It's just this transient stuff, right? And so we haven't set it up to be a venue for really serious long-term stuff, but why shouldn't it be?
That's a good question. You know, and the certainly places like, you know, the Internet Archive are offering up their answers to that question. It's certainly a new format for knowledge transfer, even though it feels like it's been around, you know, our whole careers. I know it's been around less than your whole career, and it was new at the start of mine, basically.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of norms that need to be developed. I think, on the one hand, what you're describing seems likely, that a gradient will develop between things that have more of a permanent nature and things that don't. And systems will be refined and improved to support the things that have more permanence.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's this great phrase that showed up on a Book Arts Press annual mailing a few years ago. Mess is lore. Right.
What is it?
Mess is lore.
Okay.
As opposed to less is more.
Oh, I like that. So,
the noise that comes up in these things is the stuff of legends.
Yeah.
Over time, if you look at what libraries and archives do, they end up essentially throwing a lot of things out. Things don't get saved. floods hit towns and priceless, remarkable collections like we had in New Orleans get lost. They get turned into mush, and it's tragic. But this is, in some ways, simply just what happens over time.
Yeah.
To a large extent, you really expect and hope that the best stuff gets kept reliably, but on the other hand, we know that it doesn't.
One of Tourney's points was, he talked about strategic resources. And he said, look, you're not going to make this investment in everything, but we're in the business of making this investment in this scientific discourse because, you know, we think it matters, and we think it matters for the long term. I guess I would just like to hope that there's a business model for someone in enabling somebody like me who looks at blogging as a really quite a professional sort of activity, for me to be able to make a similar investment. It's my intellectual life, and I take it very seriously, and I constantly refer to things in the past that I've written. And just the other day, I had to try to go back to something in the Byte.com archive from 10 years ago. And already, that's problematic.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
More and more people, at least I hope it will turn out this way, will be engaged in this sort of this activity that originally Dave Weiner called narrating your work. A wonderful phrase and a really evocative way of getting at what all this is still becoming. And it isn't that for many people, right? I mean, I think blogging for a lot of people is punditry.
Yeah.
We've sort of created a nation of pundits now, right? Everyone's like, oh, I have a blog now. I have a soapbox. I can rant about whatever, as opposed to, you know, I have a blog. I can articulate my public agenda in a way that forms this long-term record that, you know, helps advance my agendas and helps other people understand who I am and interact with me in a more serious and professional and productive way, right? And when you look at it in that way, you can see that, well, you know, I mean, yeah, I absolutely would pay $5 or $10 a month to have some durability and consistency and reliability to all of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I don't disagree with you at all. I think we could actually probably learn a lot by looking at the ways we're already trying to address these things. I've recently become a big fan of S3, partly through your discussion of it and hearing from other people.
Yeah.
I'm writing a column now. You know, I've got these few blogs. I've got a lot of code and data I like to keep. I'm very religiously keeping stuff in S3 using Jungle Disk and some scripts and so forth. And that's a relationship between me and Amazon, which doesn't really care about me as an author or me as a coder. On the other hand, you're not going to ask Amazon to republish your works after you die if you pass away. They're not going to do it.
Right.
That's not the relationship you've entered into. On the other hand, maybe there's an assumption that the Internet Archive will continue to keep some of your stuff alive because that's what their institutional mission is to do.
Right.
If you go from one of those extremes to the other and bit preservation versus web archiving and these different missions, I think you're going to find a lot of these same differentials that we talked about a little earlier between individual responsibility and institutional role. And certainly for academics, the role of the institution in many ways is to promote and somewhat protect the reputation of a researcher or a professor by simply standing behind them and employing them in one hand, you know, if they're tenured or whatnot. But also archives exist to take on the papers of important scholars and members of the public sphere and authors, artists, organizations, governments, you know, big companies. And it is the ongoing imperative mission of archives and other libraries to do this work. So until there is an organization that chooses as its mission to preserve my bits as an individual, I can't assume that Amazon will or the Internet Archive will because I haven't made that arrangement with them.
Yeah.
I'm not you. You know, I haven't been published like you have, and people have been reading in multiple publications over time. Your papers are probably going to be really interesting, I would presume, to maybe the Computer History Museum or another archive that collects in a similar field someday.
Well, I'm an outlying data point because I've put a pathologically large amount of stuff onto the net over the last 10 or so years. But I really am thinking in terms of anyone, any professional person, and the way in which that professional life is going to be publicly represented as a trail of documents, and that trail of documents will have been published to the internet in one form or another. And I'm certain there's a business model here for someone to help every ordinary person with this problem of long-term archiving, persistent reference, publication. And, you know, if I have any influence at Microsoft, which I probably don't, on product development, that'd be one thing that I would love to nudge its online properties in the direction of doing, because I think it's something that a lot of people will ultimately want.
Yeah, I think that's a great business opportunity. And just to turn your notion of being an outlier on its head, archives and libraries exist to support outliers, right? You know, presidential libraries are very unusual. They're only there for presidents.
Yeah.
And archives, like the Manuscripts and Archives Unit at Yale, exists to collect materials for outliers of society, people who have been prodigious artists or public figures. Now, it would make a lot of sense, I think, to take a good look at that business model and think about cost structures and, you know, what would it mean for some random blogger like me, say, to deposit my materials? What would be the arrangement that that organization and I would have? What would be the trigger event that would cause them to turn on copies of my stuff? Or if you enter into an arrangement like that, well, what do you end up doing when you recognize that literally publishing and republishing don't necessarily have to be disconnected? I mean, should there be a permanent WordPress.com or a long-term typepad.net or whatever, you know, the popular blogger.com? Should there be a long-term blogger.com where it's not free? You pay, and you pay maybe a lot more than you normally would, and the presumption is the extra payment you make is in exchange for a long-term agreement to keep your works alive.
Absolutely. I'd pay for that in a heartbeat if I were convinced that the promise could be kept, which, of course, is a really tricky thing.
Well, the great thing is that, you know, a lot of people listen to you, so I hope some of these people get that idea and we see these services soon. But I'd still want to really seriously consider the agreement you enter into with the organizations. You want to look at their board of directors and their financial structure. You'd really want to take that arrangement very seriously as an individual, probably much more so. You'd want to think about it more in terms of the amount of consideration you give writing your will.
Yeah, because we are really talking about the long run here.
Yeah.
The only real security in this model is that if it is a valid business model that works, then it will be in someone's interest to continue to hold up some version of that model over time. If it makes sense as a business, then someone will want to operate that business at some point, and that can change hands. If it doesn't make sense as a business, then it's not going to fly.
Yeah.
So, well, God, this was like a lot of fun.
It sure is.
I was thinking it would be really interesting to circle back and talk to you after you've been at the Library of Congress for a while.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, what you do there winds up being secret. I don't know if it would.
You know, I think some of what they do is probably, but I really don't know what projects I'm going to be working on.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
I'll be following your adventures. I assume that you will, to the extent that you can, be blogging about your life at the Library of Congress, right?
As soon as I get there and I learn my way around, I hope to be, yes.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, John.
Take care.